Welcome to Slovenology, the podcast with Noah Charney.
Thank you very much for coming in such huge numbers. Apparently the book fair is competition for our audience, but fair enough. It's really great of you all to come. And my guests tonight are two Peters. Peter Krečić was for a long time the director of the Architecture Museum in Ljubljana in Fužine. And I met him very early on, and you are one of the reasons why I moved to Slovenia. I met him in the fall of 2006, and I was visiting Slovenia with no particularly good reason, except I quite liked it. And I had a former girlfriend who was Slovene, and so I thought I would check this place out. And I had this idea that I might write a novel that would take place in Slovenia, and I quite liked the architecture of Jože Plečnik. And Peter very kindly invited me to meet with him and said that he had this great idea for a doctoral thesis that would be particularly good if a foreigner would write. It was about the critical reception of Plečnik's work and why Plečnik made the decisions he did to forego a maybe higher profile career in a big architecture center like Paris or New York and instead return to his homeland in Slovenia. And I thought about it for about 2 weeks, and I was doing a PhD at Cambridge University in the history of art theft, totally unrelated. And I had, as we Americans say, ants in my pants, which doesn't translate directly, mraule v hlačkach, but I was getting a little bit, I had wanderlust. I was also hunting for the future Mrs. Charney. And so I happened to meet the woman who would become the future Mrs. Charney, and I happened to sell my first book, which was a novel, which allowed me to work as a writer full-time. And this project, writing about Plečnik, seemed to sort of appear out of nowhere. And I decided that I would transfer from Cambridge to University of Ljubljana, and I would switch subjects. And I wound up finishing my PhD with Dr. Krečić as my mentor in the history of architecture and about Plečnik. And so I am very thankful to you that you helped give me reasons to stick around and make this my long-term home. Peter Schenk is another professor of architecture. He teaches in Maribor, and he also writes a number of theoretical books. And I met him because I helped him with some of the English editing of a book that we have over here. Maybe you could show it, Peter. That is Capsules, which we'll talk about more this evening, which is the theory and history of the form of capsules in architecture, which is much more interesting than it might sound at first if you're not into this sort of thing. When I first heard about the project, I was like, okay, I guess I could do this. But it was much more interesting and engaging than I had anticipated once I started reading it. And he's the author of other theoretical texts. He says he doesn't miss practicing architecture at all. And so we have two very accomplished architectural theorists, historians, and also writers about architecture. And I'm delighted to have them here. Thank you for joining us. I'd like to start maybe, Peter, you could talk a little bit about how you first fell in love with Plečnik's work and began to study him.
Oh, it's very difficult to say, to fell in love. It was something which grew up with my family. My grandfather, Anton Suchadolc, was Plečnik's right hand. He met him very early when Plečnik moved from Prague to Ljubljana, and Plečnik built a house in Trnovo for himself and his brothers and the sister. And the house was nearly finished when the builder, who was also professor of civil engineering at the faculty of technical faculty in Ljubljana, wanted to have an account about the expenses for the house. They didn't made a diary. They didn't make anything about it. There were no accounts for the material, for the working hours, and so on and so on. So they wanted to find someone who would be good enough to make such accounts, so to put up all the expenses for the building of Plečnik House in Trnovo. And Professor Krank, who was the top of professors of civil engineering at the faculty, found my grandfather, who was a kind of assistant with a degree made in Brno. He met Plečnik, and they both agreed about him to make that account. The account was made in a few days, and the builder and the commissioner were very, very satisfied with that account. So my grandfather, a young engineer, was invited to be Plečnik's right hand. At the beginning, it was very modest, the graveyard of Jesuits at Jales, in that time there was no Jales, it was just the churchyard of Holy Cross for the Jesuits. It was the first. And the next, it was Dom Duchovnichwai, or the home for the spiritual exercises for Jesuits, close to the Church of St. Joseph. My grandfather was very ambitious. So after that grave in the cemetery, he said to Plečnik, "Professor, I don't like to do that. It is too small for me." And Plečnik was very keen to stop him, to preserve him as his assistant. And he said, just wait, something bigger will come. And it happened. So the next commission was a great church of the St. Francis in Šiška. As my grandfather was a good mathematician, Plečnik wanted to have that columns in the interior of the church, 20 columns, with a perfect antique entasis. Mm. This is a curve showing that proper form of the column, showing how the tectonic forces work in the column. And Plečnik wrote to him from Prague, made of wood. Listen to me, follow my forms from this model made of wood. But my grandfather said, "Oh, it is too silly to follow this." Then he ordered three dimensions of brick in a factory for bricks. And he counted all the measures of the column from the beginning to the top, to the capital. And Plečnik was very, very excited about this form. He said, probably he saw the model for that column in Arsenale in Venice. And he saw that all these columns, so-called Doric columns, were later on elaborated with the plaster. So when he saw these perfect forms, without any mistake, he said, "No plaster." Mm-hmm. So that's why we can see bare interior columns in the church. Later on, so they were making many things together. One was the Stadium of Ljubljana, another was the bank in Celje, the school here, very close to this place, in Zgornja Šiška, the school of Gornja Šiška, and many others. And then my grandfather wanted to be an architect as well, not only as a civil engineer, but an architect. And that was not something what Plečnik would accept very likely. He was not very, very happy with that decision. So they went apart. It happened with the Baragovo Seminary when Plečnik wrote to him, "Baragovo is for me a dead thing." So my grandfather was very sad about this, and in the family, the myth of Plečnik grew up enormously. So I was living a little bit with that myth in a family. And then happened that Plečnik wanted to find a way how to get Plečnik again in this marvelous, as he described in his memoir, his marvelous ambience of feelings and cooperation and so on and so on. His daughter, the second daughter, my aunt, Natasha Suchodolc, later on married to Professor Shumi, Natasha was Plečnik's student. And he became one of the first professional conservators in architecture in Slovenia. So Natasha was a kind of bridge, a kind of link in between Plečnik and my grandfather. And when Plečnik was 80 years old, he wrote to him a letter full of emotions. So how they were together, they built wonderful things, how they traveled to Šentvid to see the holy grave and so on, so many of the sort of things. But Plečnik wrote to him very shortly. The voice, the sounds disappeared and the light vanished. And my grandfather thought it is the end. It is the end of my friendship, the end of everything. So he was very sad, because he psychologically didn't know him very well. They were very different persons. Plečnik was very profound and spiritually oriented person. My grandfather was quite practical, and never forgot for money about things. Plečnik was very generous and very so a man who made many things for free. So later on, I recognized that his letter was not meant at the end of the friendship, but it was something what Plečnik, as 80 years old man, said or wrote to himself. My light is vanishing. My sounds are disappearing in the air.
That's quite an origin story. I want to circle back to your work on Plečnik a little bit later, but I want to ask Peter number two, if you could tell us a little bit about how you got started and also how you shifted from being a practicing architect to focusing on teaching and writing.
I studied architecture, and then after a few years in practice, I worked for Stadler Vuga Architects in their formative period. I went to postgraduate studies at the Berlage Institute to Holland, and then we had a lot of discussions and the questions on the political. If architecture is political, or how the space is formed in a politically correct or incorrect ways, and so on. So, in around 2003. We had some lectures by different philosophers also there, among them also Levin de Kouter, who just published later, he published some texts, and which were then compiled in a book on capsular civilization about the city in the age of fear. He was somehow relying to some another philosopher, Dutch philosopher, René Bonkens, who was talking about the he was saying capsules, kind of territorial formations in the American deserts, which are completely artificial environments, quite unsustainable, I would say. But in a spatial way, they are really kind of closed up interiors, which also kind of transform the interrelation between people, because when you enter in this new kind of artificial environment, you also relate differently one to another, and most of the times, of course, these are kind of commercial spaces, so it's not only that anybody can go, but it's a kind of also a space of exclusion. But this concept of a capsule is then, of course, seen through these optics of capsularity, also in different kinds of formations of architectural territorial enclaves, being in transport hubs, which are bordered, controlled, or shopping malls, which are controlled, especially with surveillance cameras and so on. So this was a kind of triggering point to see the space as being formed of different capsular entities in the network, in the space of network, or the space of flows, as Manuel Castells would put it. So with a theater director who was then kind of doing his play in Rotterdam, we had a lot of discussion. His name is Emil Hrvatin, now Janis Janša. We had a lot of talks, and then we started a project on the questions of capsular society. And our first, and we opened a platform, artistic platform, with a lot of exhibitions all around the place, or even in New York and so on, called First World Camp. So this was kind of triggering point for me to get involved with the capsules and the questions of capsularity in space, which was, of course, I knew it, that it comes from architectural thinking back in the revolutionary 60s, but actually now it's transformed in a kind of metaphor of something different. In the 60s, it was a kind of liberating concept of free mobility, small capsular units moving all around the world, catering for kind of completely individualistic society, almost on the edges of anarchy. Now it's becoming the concept of something different, of a kind of totally closing up spaces, controlled, and as Levan de Carter would say, in the direction of militarization of public space, in a way. So this was a kind of triggering point, and then, of course, the research from 2003 on went in this direction. I did even the theme; it was a part of my theme for the PhD, and then part of this research, which lasted for like 10-15 years, was compacted in a book, in the first book in Slovenian, and then later also in English, which was published last year.
Maybe you could just define a little bit what you mean by capsules, because I had an idea before I read the book that was vastly expanded when I read the book, and from things like Buckminster Fuller and geodesic domes to capsule hotels in Tokyo, and there's a very broad expanse of definitions for it. What's the short version of what capsules are for you?
I somehow, according to after the studying the pioneering examples of capsules, which were also named as capsules in architecture, mainly from the late 50s, and then of course from the 60s onwards they were really called capsules, especially by two very important groups environments where this capsular architecture was kind of pioneered in England by the Archigram Group and the Cedric Price, and in Japan by the Metabolists. Somehow I would say that it's a kind of compact minimum unit which is also mobile and really equipped with different kind of communications. It can be connected to a kind of physical communication, but it can be also virtual. This is kind of very short description of this kind of minimum mobile unit, which is called the capsule, and why it's really important for the theory of architecture. From the 60s onwards, this became the minimum building block for composing architecture. Before in architecture, minimum building block was a kind of, it was a building element, like a brick, a truss, a column which you compose. But from the 60s onwards, these were these kind of minimum units which you just stack, and you can get into it because they were also prefabricated. This is another criteria to define the capsule. Of course, these are the architectural capsules. This territorial from which I started, I deny to call capsules anymore. I propose that these are called territorial capsularities or something like that.
So there's even an apartment building in Japan that's literally like a Jenga stack of almost like living pods, like pre-assembled apartments that stacked one on top of each other.
Somehow they are connected actually to two vertical masts or kind of concrete cores. This is the most famous metabolist building by Kishore Kurokawa, the Kagan Capsule Tower. There was an idea to demolish it because it's in a very central part of Tokyo, Giza, which is the prices of land probably also dictate it. But it's still there.
Okay.
There was a petition from the architect to preserve it and so on. So it was a big fight. Even Kishore Kurokawa fought to be preserved. But now, the interior of many of the capsules has been changed, but there's a lot of artists and other people moving there and rearranging the interior of the capsule, which was really, it's extremely small interior with all this kind of, it was, of course, equipped with a lot of technical stuff in the 70s. It was built in 72. But of course, it's now all the stereo. Sorry.
It's sort of falling apart and getting old.
Yeah,
it's
at the same time. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's also because it's in a very bad condition. It's covered with asbestos and so on. So has also this technical question. But some parts are being renovated. Some parts are used for even warehouses. I was lucky when I was there to enter one of these capsules where an architectural historian and theorist has a warehouse there for his Zotter chocolates, because he's the main agent for the Zotter chocolates in this part of Tokyo.
That's so random.
It was a really nice experience to go there.
Wow. Both of you have written very good books about architecture, which is not easy to do. There's always a danger that it's going to be quite dry if it's too theoretical. And both of you are good at integrating some personal biographical elements, some anecdotes, where it's not just a pure description of architectural elements. Maybe, Pippa, you could talk a little bit about how you approach writing about architecture, and also how it might differ from when you teach about architecture.
Oh, that's a very difficult question. When I was a student, we got through all the history of art, going along with the Viennese School of Art History. Means that this school includes architecture, painting, and sculpture as the main disciplines of art. So we were trained observing architecture. Professor Shumi was one of the most important teacher in architecture. He contributed to our school the ability of observing what architecture tells you. So it was very, very important source of how to experience architecture, so how to approach architecture. Because I was thinking at the very beginning that maybe painting and sculpturing, it is something what is easy to comprehend. But architecture is something getting over this. So at the end of my studies, architecture was quite close to my feelings. I think I was able to judge the problems of architecture. Besides, my degree work was Slovenian art criticism between two wars, or in interwar period. And I was writing about expressionism in painting and architecture. And of course, the first professional judgments about architecture. Because the generation of art historians, the professional art historians, were just entering the matter of that time. So Stele and Isidor Cankar, they both. Wojciech Mollet was already in Poland, so he was not relevant for these problems. and many other. So architects, also the writers, were quite very good. Were quite good. So this was my first learning about architecture. Then, through that work, so art criticism, I met the first sources, the first elements of the Slovenian historical avant-garde. And I met the hero of Slovenian historical avant-garde, August Čenegoj, when I was, for a short period, a curator in the museum in Nova Gorica, the Kronberg Castle. I remember it was just before my degree. Čenegoj had an exhibition in Kronberg Castle, and I ran down to that museum with a bus, I remember very well, and I found Čenegoj there, and he was about 60 years old, and I said, Čenegoj, just tell me what was about your constructivism. And for my great disappointment, he didn't know anything. He buried that period completely, and as I knew later, even with the Croats avant-gardists, it happens again. Maybe you know the name Joklek, Joseph Zeissel. Uh-huh. When Božo Bek came to him to ask him about his period as a Zenitist, cooperator with the review Zenit, he threw him out. It was indecent to talk about avant-garde in that time. So they completely buried this period. So later on, you have to ask this way. Čenegoj, you said to someone in an interview that you were living very close to university. Please tell me now, did you live with Ferdo Delak, another one, very important member of Slovenian historical avant-garde, in Rehar's house, to a Le Petit Café upstairs, yes, there? Or you thought that your place in a pub or a restaurant, Zagradom number 3, was close to university? Tell me about it. Oh, no, he said. I was living in Gosposka 6 by the family Arnić. And he remembered many, many details about that. Also about the visits of these left-oriented intellectuals like Kosovel, like Brother Klopčić, and many others who met him in his studio in a small cottage behind that restaurant. So the second entrance to the problems of architecture, from much more theoretical view, was my studies about Slovenian historical avant-garde. It was also my doctoral thesis, Slovenian constructivism in European frames. It was very, very interesting because all these people, being painters or sculptors, they were all very interested in architecture. So Čenegoj's major decision was his ambience in the Trieste exhibition in 1927, when he and his close friend Edvard Stepančić built a special ambience, constructivist ambience, in the middle of quite very average Trieste production in 1927. So it is now reconstructed in Moderna Galleria completely, and it is, from my opinion, one of the biggest artistic decisions, achievements in between two wars at all. That's ambience. So they were very, very, these people were very educated. They knew enormous, they had enormous knowledge about European avant-garde, from futurist, dadaist, everything. And also they have a special interest in architecture. So this was my second, more theoretical entry to to the problems of architecture. And at last, I changed my job in Gorica, and Mattia Murko, this year he died in Kamnik. He was my first director, and we started to build architectural museum directly on Plečnik's furniture, his models, his maps of portfolios of projects. Everything was there, so it was impossible to not to react on this fantastic materials I've got. I came to the museum in 1973, and the next year the Plečnik house was open to the public. And then I started to go through all his projects and models and photographs and everything. So this was more than 15 years of drowning this material all the time, so diving deeply in Plečnik secrets. And the result was the monograph printed in 1992. And I have to say something about Micha Kovač, who was one of the top officials in Državna založba, who understood that it was a national project. So the book was out, and from that book I made a smaller one. So this is the first one. It's about 1,000 pages with all these apparatus. Yeah. Then I made the second one. You probably knew.
I had the English translation of the slimmer version, but yes, you also mentioned you weren't happy with the English translation. So I'm actually curious if you could talk a little bit about the process.
I was very happy with all three languages. Okay. It was four publishing houses in three languages. So it was the Whitney Library of Design in New York. It was the Academy editions in London, and then French edition in Liège, Belgium, and the Italian edition was that in the middle of this project. Yeah. So what happened to me is that the publisher was not fair. He shortened the text, especially the end, and I had no view inside the last version.
Okay.
So that is something what we have to put all this story on the court.
Yeah.
And I won.
Yeah. Good. That is how I got to know you. It's also how I got to know Plečnik. And that version that was in English, I remember I was looking for a Plečnik book to buy, and there aren't a lot of them, but then especially not in English, but that one had this title that wasn't in your original, if I recall. It was Plečnik, The Complete Works.
Exactly, and it was not true.
It's interesting, untrue. But from a marketing perspective, I remember choosing that one because I didn't know the difference, and I said, I'll get the one with everything in it. So from a marketing perspective, it worked.
I wanted to do it with the thick book, to go through and put everything in the book. But I said, if I put it, the complete work, there will be, and in Slovenia it's very, very, very often, that someone finds something and he said, no, it is not complete work.
There's always
missed that.
Yeah, of course. Peter, when you're talking about a book that you might like to write, and I'm also considering the different approaches, because you've taught in a number of different countries, you give lectures in the Netherlands, you gave a talk at the Royal Institute of British Architects in London not long ago, do you adjust the way that you teach to different nationalities? And this is where I'm shifting, because I want to bring in American versus Slovenian approaches to writing about architecture and learning about it. I'm curious if in any way you vary the way that you teach, or do you find a reaction in your audience is any different depending on the nationality of the students?
Well, this is really a good question. And to be honest, just to correct you, I had a lecture at the Architectural Association, School of Architecture. Well, of course, the lectures or the teaching is adjusted to the audience which is to be listening. So basically, I always ask if there are students, which grade are they? Are they postgrads or? So that I can somehow adjust also the theoretical level, I would say, of the talk. Of course, after each time, after the reception of also some questions, answers, I reevaluate the success or or maybe a failure of the lecture. But usually, it's always a learning process. You never know how far you can go. But sometimes, of course, the lecture is not usually completely a block which is you're supposed to run through. But there are some parts which are maybe left out or maybe included if the audience is more curious or kind of going very carefully with you through the lecture. I think I allow myself usually to do that.
There are a couple of things that I've found in teaching to different nationalities, and I'm curious if you've had similar experiences. One is that American students will have specialized much later and much less. So most American students at university take lots of different courses, and only half of them are usually in the specialized major. And so the equivalent of 21-year-old American is unlikely to have gone into anywhere near the depth of someone like in England who has taken only courses in one subject for all three of their undergraduate years. Mm-hmm. So when I shifted from undergraduate in the US to postgraduate degrees in England, I had a lot of catching up to do because all of the people who just finished undergraduate there had essentially done only, for instance, history of art for the last 3 years. I also learned in the US by being asked lots of questions, and if I didn't respond, then I wasn't going to get a good grade. And it was different from the expectations of students in Slovenia that I've had, where it's more of a lecture base. And they're supposed to write down things we say as professors and memorize it and then essentially say it back to us. Whereas I had almost none of that in the US. I remember architecture seminars. There was one I had Tuesday nights at 8 p.m. and we would order takeout pizza, and half the students would be in their pajamas because that was what was cool to dress in at the time at university. We would be shown slides and the professor would say, "Do you like this?" And there was a lot of that where it was very informal and conversational, and he would argue in favor of, for instance, a brutalist building that most of the students would say they didn't like aesthetically, and he would try to bring in good points. One I remember very vividly was that architecture is about space that's created by walls. It's not about facades, which is what most people initially think of, and it gets you thinking, but you also have to argue your point, and this idea that your opinion is very important and the way you phrase it has just as much value as the professor does was a very different approach from what I've experienced in continental Europe. I'm wondering if you've noticed any differences over maybe also your careers as teaching, because you've been teaching over a period of time. Have things changed perhaps from your early days teaching to your students? For instance, this evening you had a group of students. Are they very different organisms?
Yes, they are. So my two students at the Faculty of Design do not read anything, do not read newspapers. I don't know what they read at all. Formerly, I taught the students of Biotechnical Faculty, the landscape designers, at the very beginning. Then I was for a short time at the Faculty of Architecture. And they were quite different publics, I think. And unfortunately, I cannot follow these students, since they were mostly working in studios of professors. And they were more or less led by these people in the studios. So I was a man who came from the outside. And it was quite different to the manners of the faculty the way of teaching in the faculty was completely different from my way of teaching. So I was not in a position to judge what was my contribution in their studies. I don't know. Absolutely, I don't know. And even now, I don't know what is the impact of my lectures and so on. Just few years ago, I found this something, what would be the key to understand what is happening now in architecture, in the art at all. Because we are living for more than 200 years in modernism. Mm-hmm. Not to say not to go into the details about the 19th century. I saw the development in 19th century as the graduate destroying the iconography, destroying the form, destroying everything. At the end, we have this complete destroyed, let's say, the artistic surface into the forms. And from that destruction, the modern artist builds something new. So what is all the sense of this? It is, in fact, the systematically destroying the classical order. The classical order was introduced by the Renaissance, the High Renaissance, and then renewed with the Baroque. So the end of the Baroque, the end of so-called Gesamtkunstwerk, is the beginning of the modern thinking, when the big themes and big form is put aside. And instead of that, it is something what is going on at the margin of the society, or the margin of the art problems and so on. And we have about 1968, something like that, when Manet exposed his Olympia, the first public disagreement of the public from the art. So we have a great break in between the artist and the public. So I wanted to teach students about what is antique art. Sculpturing, painting, there's quite few, big paintings in Greek art from Pompeii, and architecture. So I wanted to teach them what is ideal, what is the biggest achievement of European art at all. Perfection. What is perfection? So art around the goddess and heroes with the perfect form, so the perfect in the sense of tectonics in architecture and contrapost in sculpturing. So the Miloš Kosec had a good point when he said these people didn't see the ruin. The ruin is something what is neglected. It is something it doesn't matter. So the people of the end of Baroque discovered the ruin and put it in the front of the interest and so on. So what is next? Modernism is destroying, and maybe it is perfect only in destroying and working at the margins of everything in the life, in the form, and in architecture and everything. So I think that this is quite important, because I think that they don't know why this difference in the history of art and what is essential for the modernism to understand. That's it.
Okay. I'm interested in the influence of American architecture or theory in European practice and perhaps in Slovenia. And then I'm going to come back to you and ask about the only big Slovenian architect to work in the U.S., who we've talked about before, Mr. Jagr?
Jagr was not the biggest one.
Okay.
But he was important because he was sent to China in 1901, sent as an architect to rebuild the Austro-Hungarian embassy, which was destroyed in the rebellion of Boxers. Jagr met. Jagr was the first thing. He was the student of High Technical School of Vienna. In Vienna, there are two schools of architecture. One is Academy. There was Otto Wagner and Plečnik and his colleagues by Otto Wagner. This is Academy. And the title of the architect was Academical or Architect without anything. The High Technical School in Vienna was the school, was architecture school more oriented to technology, building, materials, and so on and so on. So the title of the architect is Engineer Architect. Okay. This was Fabiani, this was Wurnik, and this was also Janusz Jagr. So Jagr was sent to China, and he became interested in Chinese and Japanese art. And he made a wonderful collection of, let's say, of that rings of samurai swords. Uh-huh. And enormous. It was of extreme value and lost after the Great Depression in America. Uh-huh. But at the very early period, he contributed to Minneapolis, the great plan for the Minneapolis, made under the influence of Max Fabiani. Mm-hmm. It was published. We made many, many years ago a small catalog, and that plan is published there. But later on, he became an important writer about architecture. So the Minnesotan and other publications were very important for him. And he was very, very modern-oriented architect. So a kind of precursor of let's say Giddens and his when machine takes command in architecture. So he was in that side of this progressive part of architecture. At the same time, he got connected with Plečnik. And when Plečnik started to build the National Library, Jagr kept him sending the material from American university libraries. But Plečnik, if you see the introduction to his small booklet about where he published the plans of the National University Library, you will see that he took only one thing from Wagner's teaching. This is 2 meters and 20 for the boxes for the storage of the books. Nothing else. So Plečnik was interested in that symbolic. A symbolic staircase and the sanctuary, which is the reading room and so on. So it is not only the getting knowledge coming to the light, it was a symbolic way to come to enlightenment, God's enlightenment, you say. So he put aside his... But their correspondence is quite interesting. And then Jagr wrote in a certain letter about 1936 when they started building the National Library. He wrote to Plečnik. And then they will come, these villains like Mussolini and these people, and they will come with their aircraft and they will burn your library. And then it happened. In 1944, an Italian airplane, Italian aircraft, a post in a function of a post aeroplane in German service. This aeroplane crashed down to the National Library and to the reading room. And there was a great fire. And Plečnik remembered that letter. He took it out from the archive and wrote with a sharp pencil, you were a good Prophet Jagr.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I think it is perfect perfect scene for the cinema,
movie. Yeah,
for
absolutely.
The movie.
Yeah. Petra, I wonder if you could talk a little bit now, as we get to the conclusion of our talks this evening, what Americanness in terms of architecture has filtered over into Europe and changed the way architecture functions in terms of either theory or practice or both? Or maybe you could say something, what is American architecture to you and how is it influenced here?
Well, of course, I have quite part of my work is also concentrated on some American examples. Also in the capsules, there's, of course, in the genealogy, which I follow kind of making up the capsules, a special kind of feature in architecture, is a line from Buckminster Fuller from the 20s, and then of course also in the counterculture in the 60s and 70s from United States. But this is just one part. I think the American scholars, the American theorists, historians are also extremely important in our series, which we publish in Slovenian. The Theoretical Practice of Architecture. We published four books with mainly theoretical titles. We translate some canonical text from the kind of most prominent architectural theorists, like we did a book on tectonics there are some older texts from Bütticher and Semper, but there's also the major text by Kenneth Frampton, who was teaching at Columbia. We also published a translation of Anthony Fiedler's book, Histories of Immediate Present, which is, of course, trying to expose the making up of different modernisms, or deconstructing the one idea of one modernism in kind of four directions, which are really interesting, by Emil Kaufmann, which he calls classicist modernism, then Colin Rowe, mannerist modernism, Tafuri with his Renaissance modernism, and of course Rainer Benham, was also British, but then he moved after, in the late part of his career, moved to LA, being fascinated with this environment, with his futurist modernism. So, in a way, there is of course a lot of things going on, and what I see in many conferences by the what is presented by American theorists, it's interesting that. The French philosophy is still very vivid in their thoughts, and of course in arguing for architectural in design and theoretical conclusions. When we think sometimes that in Europe it's not so hype anymore. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there is a lot of exchange. It's really difficult, I think, to position what is really American, what is not American. But I would also mention after I published the Slovenian book, I was trying to find a publisher and also the translator for the English version of the book, which was later published by the Routledge, which is a global academic publisher with publishing in New York and London and New York. It was very interesting to work with you, because also the Slovenian text in Slovenian, doesn't have that many small details when I was writing about, I don't know, when I just said Gideon said something. I mean, I was expecting that everybody who reads my book knows who Siegfried Gideon was. But then with the special emphasis, you were saying, no, for Anglo-Saxon kind of readers, it's good that you explain more. It relates to this specialization, of readers, or non-specialization. I think at least 15% of the translated book is 10 to 15, I couldn't count really, is changed or added and transformed. So basically it's not the direct translation, it's many, many sources which are important for a Slovenian audience or readers is omitted, and there is a new content being developed and written even for the English edition.
That's a very important point, and it's not just in architecture, but I wind up teaching this regularly, and when I help Slovenian writers find publishers, I go through this and essentially re-explain the same thing. For American readers in particular, but Anglophone in general, the job of the writer is to make the reader feel smart. And if at any moment the reader feels dumb because you've mentioned something that they can't follow or they aren't familiar with, then the immediate defense mechanism will be for them to think that you've written badly. That may not be true. They should probably know this, but that is the way that they tend to react. So editors will say, better to over-explain than risk alienating the reader. And I had I helped Jože Pirjevec with the English version of Tito and Tovarishi, which is this giant biography of Tito, which is 700 pages long with 3,000 citations. And he was getting extremely annoyed at all the things that I was sure Anglophone readers wouldn't know, and that he thought everybody should know this, otherwise, what are you, idiots? And there says, yes, we are, as a matter of fact, especially dealing with, you know, a history that's not our own. So that's maybe the biggest difference, that I could imagine being annoying from some perspectives, but the question is, who is your readership going to be? If they're postgraduate students in architecture, no problem. But on the off chance that you're going to get a layperson who's interested in, that's the real major difference, is the need to make the reader feel smart, which may be catering to the lowest common denominator, if we're being negative, or it may be widening your audience is the positive approach to it. Just before we finish up for today and give the audience a chance to ask some questions, one last question for both of you. Could you tell us a little bit about your next project? I know you have a volume you're editing, and you have one that's coming out in a few weeks. Would you go first, maybe?
Yeah, I'm working on a book for the same series, Theoretical Practice of Architecture. We have the next topic, which is called Function in Architecture. It will be an edited book with 4 or 5 translated texts by architects and architectural theorists, even philosophers, on the topic of function in architecture. There will be the original text by Louis Sullivan, of course, the main reference on function, form follows function, or form all ever follows function. There will be 2 short texts by Hannes Meyer. There will be the text Functionalism Today by Theodore Adorno, translated. Another text by Rudolf Arnheim, another view, and most kind of recent, but still in the 90s, text on ecological functionalism by Juhani Palasma. Of course, it will be also supported or kind of wrapped together with my study, to trying to explain that the function is not just the main purpose, but maybe much more. Of course, relying on all these texts and many more, which we couldn't be added to the volume which we were proposed. So the book is on the way, and it will be published next year. It should have been published already, but we had some financial things to overcome, and hopefully they will be overcome the next year.
Great. And Peter, tell us about your book that's coming out soon.
Well, first of all, I wanted to publish the first monograph again, because there are so many years and there are so many new things to be published or renewed or explained again or something, that this would be necessary, I think. But the publishing house, Belletrina, came to me and asked me whether I would be able to write about Plečik more as a person, more as a man, as a genius, so more oriented to him than to architecture. So I took this challenge, and the book is coming out in a few weeks, probably. Of course, the book is illustrated, because you cannot talk about a man who worked in the visual arts without visual support, supporting material. So there are about 200 illustrations. But this is a story about Plečnik. So this is not a scientific work. Means there is no footnotes, nothing. This is just his language, his statements or observations from his letters, his affairs with women, his brothers. He was sometimes very sympathetic, very, very kind and soft person. From another side, he would be very rough and violent. Means that he had a terrible quarrels or arguments with his brother, and sometimes when he was not very satisfied, even with my grandfather. So he brought out whatever he thought about, doesn't care about his people who are around and so on. And then after 2 hours and a half, it was described by his student Lenarčič, he calmed up and immediately everything was forgotten, as it never happened. So this kind of story will be now.
What's the title going to be?
Plečnik, The Life for Perfection.
Okay, great. Well, thank you both for being my guests this evening. It was a pleasure. I hope it was interesting for you too. You're maybe foreigners, so maybe you're not scared of asking questions. One difference when I teach Slovene students, nobody wants to ask any questions. Anglophone students, there's lots of questions always at the end, and I usually have to sort of tell people they're not allowed to leave Slovene students unless they ask at least 3 good questions. We won't hold you to that tonight, but does anyone have questions for me or for our guests? Yeah.
Hello. I have 3 questions.
Great. Okay, all in one.
one for each.
Okay.
First for you, why is your book about Plečnik not here?
Oh, that's a fair question. That's because I forgot it at home. That's the quick answer. I do have a book that was based on my dissertation, and Peter very kindly wrote the foreword for it, and it's a very beautiful book. You don't have to read the text except for Peter's foreword, but it's got great photographs. The photographer from the City Museum took over 5,000 photographs to fill out the archive. Mateusz Paternoster, yeah, and it was a beautiful design by Domen Fras. And I learned not long ago that we won the award for best book at the Novi Sad Architecture Fair.
Yes.
And we came in second place for Slovenian Book of the Year last year. So I was delighted that it was so well received, and it was really a group project. So thank you for asking about it. It's sort of sold out. I think they had a limited print run. You can still get some copies at the City Museum bookstore or online. But I'm running out of copies myself, but I probably should have brought it. But that would seem like shameless self-promotion, so thank you for offering the question.
Congratulations for the award.
Thank you.
I had the honor to drive your books from Ljubljana to Novi Sad.
You're kidding!
Because my friend Fras, Domen, asked me to do it. I was organizer for the salon.
Oh, thank you so much. That's really cool.
It's a very nice design book indeed. So
it's really beautiful. He did a great job.
And of course, I didn't have a chance to read it entirely, but of course, I don't doubt that it is...
That's okay too. It's one of the books you put on your coffee table and you push that, and that's it.
Is it the complete Plečnik?
It's not complete, but it's an alternative view of his life through his works. But no, it's definitely not complete. And it also has as little architectural analysis as possible, because that's already been done, especially by Dr. Krečić and his books on it. So I didn't want to repeat that necessarily, so I was trying to approach it from a slightly different angle. But as long as people buy it, they don't have to read it. That's always the authors always think that. So you have questions for these guys too.
I'd like to ask Professor Krečić, maybe if you can comment on the fact that maybe what is your opinion about 2 projects that happened lately in Ljubljana, which maybe in some kind of my perception connect this axis from the south square.
Sorry. Can you speak more loudly?
Yes. I'm sorry. can you maybe do a small comment about the fact that two projects have been finished in Ljubljana lately? One is the monument at the South Square, na Kongresnom trgu, Kongresni trg, and the other is renovation of Plečnik's home. And now this axis of Plečnik seems to have the beginning of the end, and the end, which is actually in a way architecturally the architecture is nice. And
I hope I understood. Look, I'm very happy for Plečnik House. I was living in that house, repairing all the problems because Plečnik was very modest, and in fact, it was his statement. For me, it's good enough, but for you, I can make a palace. That's why the house was, maybe you know, it was covered with registration lepenka. Well, it was called like a hen house. My grandfather proposed a copper roof. Mm-hmm. But Plečnik said, yeah, but this is too expensive. And then they went to Repnje to ask his brother a copper or something else. And his brother he wanted to make a balance. A sinful roof. So it was not very expensive, but it was not just common, hen house covering. So I'm very happy that this house is now in a very good order. The architect was very good, so they made a really proper entrance with all the services and so on. So this is something what Plečnik deserved. Another thing is, of course, the way to the center. Plečnik built Ljubljana from his house to the very center, going on this land axis, aside the water axis, directly to the Congress Place, and finished by the Southern Square. Now, these two concrete blocks are blocking the idea of Plečnik Southern Square. I still believe that this square should be done in a very modern way, but Plečnik's basic idea would be preserved. Now, this would be very, very difficult with that. I saw the contribution of my uncle in the last Sobotna Priloga about the hand of Kalin and the sword in his hand as a kind of contribution. I think it is quite a funny solution, but a little bit, for my feeling, like the end of the First World War, like that. So the monument to the First World War or something. So a little bit out of date. So there is no solution for that monument, except I hope, and I think that Slovenian architects are good enough to avoid this obstacle at the beginning of the Southern Square and still make a good solution for the Plečnik Southern Square. And just to addition, I would be very happy whether the mayor of Ljubljana, Mr. Janković, would accept the same criteria for the Plečnik Stadium as they were introduced in Plečnik's house. The same, not the project which he supports very strongly.
Thank you.
Don't mention it.
I hope so too. I don't know how it doesn't get to this after all these years. I have one question more for Peter Schenk. I know a little bit about your book, Capsules, and I was always wondering, and I use it also, your book, for my thinking, for my own little projects that I do, and I'm always intrigued by one specific part of the book where you talk about capsules and you talk about duality of the function of the capsule, which in one way it enables you to isolate yourself and isolate yourself from the obstacles that surround you in a way, but in another way it also enables the control of the outside world to be enhanced because you lose the contact with your network. This some kind of double-edged sword of the capsule. I was thinking maybe if you have some kind of broader comment on this problematic of the capsule, and also I was intrigued about thing I found as a relation to this problem is one comment by Slavoj Žižek, which in his work the film and video when he talks about nature and the distance of, from the nature, the work is called Examined Life. He talks about cutting off connections with nature totally to be able to objectively perceive what the world is. So I was always intrigued to how to combine these views of the capsule, the problematic of duality of the capsule, and this cutting off of the nature, and if this goes in favor of one type of function of capsule. I hope I was clear enough.
I hope you will tell me later. I think this duality is really exposed in the book, and of course after the 70s the concept of the capsules, although many architects try to build the capsules for themselves as the capsule as a kind of housing proposal was actually doomed. It's a question, it was of course evaluated also by the theories, of course. Also, if you think about the question of alienated masses, about which Guy Debord talks and the situation is, we all know that there is, of course, when you alienate from the society, you get enclosed in the capsules. You cut all the connections from the outside world, but you have a possibility to be connected to the outside world via media. It's the question of individual strength to resist it. Because if an individual is alienated and has access only to the media, the media becomes the totally manipulated source. So basically, you're not disconnected, but you are more manipulated than if you were, I don't know, somewhere in a group. So I understand this problem. I expose it also in my writings, in the book. But still, I somehow, what I call at the end of these descriptions, that I call for what I call dialectic rehabilitation. That it's impossible to look at the capsules as completely kind of black and white phenomena, but always a kind of concept of possibilities. But of course, maybe it's utopian, but there is some power to be rethought in the concept, and that's why it is exposed. And of course, this is also the question or the problem of the connections to the nature or not. Many capsules are actually extremely efficient, especially in the very unfriendly environment for human existence. They are as kind of shelters or somewhere in the kind of in Antarctica and so on. But also, I include in the concept of the capsules the project of MacroLab, which we probably all know by Marco Pilhan and his group, which by alienating from the society, being somewhere in the nature, enabled a new social codes and new knowledge and research to be initiated in this kind of environment. So, away from the nature, but still in contact with this kind of wild nature, this connection causes something new to emerge. And this, in this way, I think it should be looked at, this concept should be looked at in a kind of dialectic way, if I answered the question.
Yes.
Thank you very much. That's all we have time for, but those were three very good questions, I think. And thank you so much all for coming. You're welcome to come next month on December 19th. I also host events in Slovene, in Ljubljana, Kamnik, and Domžale, and you're welcome to come to any of those if you like in the future. But thank you very much for being such a great audience this evening, and have a good rest of the night. Papa.
Thank you.